Welcome to the Wise Life Podcast. My name's Dina Morris and I'm a yoga teacher and hypnotherapist here to help you get the best out of life, sharing tools, tips and tactics for powerful aging with wisdom and joy.
And today I am thrilled to have as my guest yoga teacher, Sanskrit student, and lawyer, Sue Baker. Yeah, Sue's talents are diverse and her passion for life is vibrant. However, she's hit her challenges along the way, and some of those challenges would floor the best of us. But before we dig into that, I just want to flag up that Sue's generally given us an hour of her time. So we're going to rattle through some of those amazing insights that I know that she has and listen to some of the tools that she's implemented to get through some of the tougher challenges that we face on our journeys. So Sue, welcome. Welcome to Wise Life.
Thank you, Dina, and thank you, everybody. Wow, after that introduction, where do we go from here?
I know. It's an extraordinary life lived, Sue. And I met you on a yoga business training course, I think, which gives listeners some idea of how excited you are about developing who you are and what you do. Even though if I could share with our listeners that you are into your 60s now, so you are moving through the post-menopause years, sparkling and joyful, which is such a lovely, a lovely thing for us to meet and see, because I know that moving through menopause all change can feel very dramatic at times, can't it? But what I wanted to start with is some of the questions that I'll be asking all listeners as we move through these interviews. And one of the first is, what are some of your self-care go-tos that you've put together for yourself over the years that you know work for you?
They've probably changed over the years to being a lot more healthy. Back in the day, it might have been a glass of wine and some chocolate or something like that. These days, it's probably a little different. Maybe a lovely bath with a really good book and some scented candles, something smelly, some lovely oils and things in the bath. Absolutely can't beat that. I also love music. I find music very, very evocative. And I will use music just to kind of help with the way I'm feeling. You know, the power of music, what you choose, it's just so inspirational and it just speaks right to your heart and it can just take you to other places. I've also realized over the years that actually I'm an introvert, which is very strange and probably surprises a lot of people because I'm quite out there in many ways. But in my heart, I'm an introvert and I do genuinely like a bit of quiet time alone with myself. So for me, self-care looks like finding a bit of quiet time, maybe listening to some music, maybe reading a book. And latterly, it's been just darkening the room, lighting some scented candles and doing a yin yoga practice.
Which I
absolutely love.
It's an amazing way to get into yourself, isn't it? Find that nice, cozy, deep space. Interesting that you have this realization that you see yourself now as an introvert. Is that right? Yeah.
That's absolutely right. It's taken me ages, you know, and I used to think, what is wrong with me? Everybody wants to go to all the wild parties. Everybody wants a million people around them all the time. And actually, I found that would deplete me. And I just genuinely need to tap in and plug into my own time. Don't get me wrong. I really like people very, very much. I like company. But I just genuinely need that quiet time to recharge and regroup Sometimes I will, if I'm going on a journey, because with my job, I do a lot of driving. I work in several offices and I have to drive. And sometimes I just turn off the car radio and I've got to where I'm going before I even know it. And there's not been one, you know, it's just all been going on. You know, I'm just vastly entertained by what's going on in my head. It sounds a bit self-centered, but it's not. It's just that I'm cogitating and thinking over things. And, you know, there's just so much kind of going on. So, yeah, I relish a bit of time on my own.
And being with yourself and in yourself.
Yeah.
Do you think this interest in exploring the self is something that we develop with age, and maybe that's where that passion for philosophy comes from? I noticed that you flag that in your Instagram bio, don't you? You know,
yeah,
philosophy nerd, I think is how you phrase it.
Yeah, well, I'm actually a nerd. I could claim nerdism about so many things. I just am that nerd. But funnily enough, I'm unashamedly about to be 66. I'm like about 6-8 weeks off that, and I'm actually super excited. I actually celebrate birthdays. I don't regret, you know, oh, I'm getting older. It's just like, yay, another one, go me. And I've actually not found age to be a limiting factor in any way. You know, it doesn't stop, my age does not actually stop me from doing anything I want to do. So I'm really cool about age, and I actually celebrate getting older. I think it's really great. So just to wind back to where we were going, back when I was a teenager, and I'm actually an Australian born and bred who emigrated to the UK at 21. So as a teenager living in Australia, as a young person, sort of 15 or 16, I was really interested in the Beatles and their journey with transcendental meditation. So I was really, really keen on all of that side of yoga, if you like, although I didn't necessarily recognize that it was yoga. My mum and dad had a friend, and she had a really bad back, but she went to yoga. So, you know, I'd heard of this yoga, but I was really interested in the philosophical side. So I did a lot of reading around all of that, you know, back then when I was a teenager. And I actually think that your teenage years are very formative. In my case, the music I liked when I was 15 or 16 is very much coloured and remained with me to these days, even though my tastes have widened and I like all sorts of music. Certainly I do hark back to the music of the late 60s and early 70s and love that. So yeah, I know I've always been a bit of a geek. I've always loved that sort of thing. But yes, certainly my journey with philosophy has deepened over the years. And yeah, you want to get to know a little bit more about how you tick and why you tick in certain ways.
Absolutely. Yeah, my experience is very similar. I knew when I was doing my yoga teacher training that I wanted to know more about philosophy. Didn't really get the Gita. Still find elements. I understand it better now that I study Vedanta, I think, which is interesting. I've come at it at a completely different angle through the Upanishads from a completely different thought system. But it makes more sense to me now. But I bought a book on Vedanta back then, thinking, I don't understand what this book's saying, but it interests me. And yet Vedanta popped up as a course that I could study in January. And now suddenly this book makes absolute sense to me. So it's almost as if things that you discover along the path are there for you. It's just you don't have the capacity to understand the tools in the way that the tools can be understood, and you pick them up a little bit further down the road, if that makes sense.
That makes total sense, and that's exactly how I see it, and how I've experienced things as well. You know, there's lots of things, just as you described, that you've sort of come across and you've thought, well, it's interesting, but I can't make head nor tail of this. And it's almost like it's enticing you on, but you're just not ready. Yeah. And then other things happen, things fall into place, and you think, well, gosh, you know, this has all been leading me towards this. Now it makes perfect sense.
Absolutely. I had a book when I was 18, I think. I found it in my boyfriend's bedroom, which is probably telling you more about my teenage years. But I was absolutely absorbed in this book, and it was about a monk in Tibet. And I just became fascinated with Tibet and Nepal. And I'd done some yoga as a teenager with my mum, so I kind of knew about yoga. My yoga teacher's yoga teacher had said to my yoga teacher, oh, I think this one could probably be a yoga teacher herself. And that stuck in the back of my head for a good 25, 30 years before I did anything about it.
Yeah, it was brewing and developing. So the seed was there. Interesting what you said about Tibet, because I am a voracious reader. As a young child, I was always a voracious reader. I have a sister, and my sister is 7 years younger than me. So in a way, growing up, it was almost like two only children, because she was too young for me to play with or do anything. She was a little baby. But I got into reading. I was a voracious reader, and I used to raid my mum and dad's library, reading things far beyond my years that I didn't necessarily understand. But at a reasonably young age, I read 7 years in Tibet, which I didn't know it was called Tibet. It was Tibet to me. But anyway, I read this book and I was absolutely fascinated. I was hooked. It was so interesting about, you know, the tea and the Dalai Lama and the yak butter and, you know, all the different things. It was just absolutely brilliant. So yeah, I have a similar fascination.
And the way those little seeds are kind of planted back in the furrows a long time ago, and it just takes longer for things to grow. So, yeah, I think if there's what I'm hearing you say, and it's an experience that I've noticed with myself as well, I find a lot of joy in activities that I enjoyed as a child now that I wouldn't have given as much time for or appreciated in the same way 10, 15 years ago. Does that make sense? Things like craft, being out in nature, just lying in fields and staring at clouds and looking at trees and leaves and listening to birds.
Yeah, that makes total sense. And I find the same, you know, I am returning to some of those things, but with a kind of renewed enthusiasm and a fresh eye. You know, I think possibly appreciating them even more from this perspective.
Absolutely. Well, you're just talking about your self-care go-tos and your baths and your yin yoga. And of course, in all the great conversations, they start before I start recording. So I just wanted to throw back to something we spoke about earlier, which was your crow posture and the fact that you love exploring these like full-on asanas. And I mean, that crow's pretty strenuous, and yet you are there testing your crow every morning, aren't you? Could you like just tell our listeners a little bit about that, because it's such an inspirational story if you're into yoga.
Okay, well, first of all, I've been blessed with really big arms. So on a really superficial level, you know, I've always loved the sculpted spaghetti yogic arm, but I actually have big arms. My mum has big arms, and I think it's in the family. But now as a yogi, I bless my big arms because they're great for when I want to do arm balances, which I do purely for my own entertainment and fun. And I just enjoy staying strong, and I enjoy exploring. There's no prizes for doing these things. It doesn't give me a hierarchy. It doesn't make me better than anybody else. It doesn't move me up any ladders. It's just purely for my own entertainment, and it just brings a smile to my face. So yeah, I indulge in a bit of bathroom yoga. So I'm really going to overshare here. So crow pose or Bakasana is when you Dina, can you describe that a bit better for me?
Oh yes, okay. So crow is kind of, if you were to imagine lying on your back curled in a little ball with your knees up to your chest and your hands sort of resting on your shoulders. And then you flipped that. So your hands were on the floor and your knees were on your... We're not doing a very good job, are we, as two yoga teachers? Well,
the back of your upper arms.
Yeah. That would be crow. It's quite easy to do on your back. And whenever I'm a great one for teaching what I can't do, and crow, I've never got it, but I've got a friend who assures me I need to practice with my head against a mattress, you know, at the side of the bed.
Yes.
So that fear of breaking your nose as you tip over is not going to happen. And I've tried piling up cushions, Sue, and the fear of falling on my face is just greater than my awareness that cushions are going to save me. But I'm astounded that, you know, I mean, I love the way that you go for it with from that mindset of I'm just playing here. This is for fun. This is not about me performing or showing somebody that I can do this. This is just for my own amusement. And a lot of those full-on yoga postures are, they are considered like for performance. You see people trying so hard, don't you? Because yes, they feel like it's like an exam. You know, if you can't do it, then
you're not good enough. So what we're getting to is, so that's crow, but there is something called side crow, which is called Parsva Bakasana. And that involves still balancing your knees on your upper arms in the same way, with the face pointing forward and about maybe 6 inches from the ground. But both of your knees are to one side of your body. So it does require strength in the upper arms, it requires strength in the wrists, but it also requires a good degree of mobility and twist in the body. And I am a strong person, but not a naturally bendy person. So in order to get to this journey, I've been months and months and months doing lots of yoga practices, lots of twists, lots of preparatory work with no expectation, but reaping massive benefits along the way, because I've, you know, in thinking, oh, I'd like to work towards Parsva Bakasana, side crow. I need to develop this flexibility in my body. But that flexibility is carried through into every other thing I've done. So the gifts have been tremendous. And then, strangely enough, I like a bit of bathroom yoga. So we're talking bra and pants here, people. We're talking damp thighs from the shower. We're talking bra and pants, a bath mat in case I face plant, and a wall nearby. So every morning I have a little go. And much to my amazement, I suddenly found I could do Parsva Bakasana. Absolutely wonderful. And then I've taken it a little bit further. There's another pose called Ekapada Kundinyasana, and there's a one and a two, and I don't know if I'm talking about one or two, but it's one that you're still in a twisted pose, so your front leg is facing out to the side and your back leg's flying up in the sky behind you. So I thought, well, I'll just have a little go at this. And you know, I'd read up about it, I'd done lots of drills, done lots of strength work. Obviously I'm a yoga teacher, I have a very regular practice. So I started off, and I'm a fan of a prop. So, you know, whatever external aids can help you, use them. Bricks, blocks, walls, belts, use them. So I started off with the back foot on the wall. And then this morning, for some random reason, I just took flight in both directions. And I could not stop smiling and laughing. I mean, you know, it's no biggie for anybody else. There's me and my bra and pants and my wet legs. But it was absolutely wonderful, and it just made me feel little lift.
You're beautifully encapsulating the joy of yoga there as well. So, you know, it's like this idea that it's very serious as well, isn't there? And it can be tremendous fun. In fact, I think, you know, the element of fun in yoga is what we should be teaching, or, you know, it's me being prescriptive, but I find that people get an idea much more clearly if it feels like it's fun than if it feels like it's really serious.
Oh, totally. I take my yoga very, very, very seriously, but I usually find something to laugh about and hope that my students will also find something to laugh about with me, maybe at me, in most of my classes, because and I bring the same thing to law. When I was training and working with somebody, a very, very good lawyer, who used to say, you know, he had a load of fun doing law. And I've always said, having a laugh, having a bit of fun does not make you bad at your job. It just lightens the load, gives everybody a lift. Doesn't, you know, having a laugh does not make you bad at your job.
Absolutely not. And talking about the law, because that's very different from yoga, isn't it? Was that your first career choice or?
Yes.
Yes.
Well, it was a second career. It was a midlife career, if you like. My parents had always wanted me to go to university and do law because, you know, the careers person at school thought she's gobby. She could probably do law. But I was like, oh, no, I don't want to be Perry Mason. So, of course, I didn't do it. I did what all young people did, which was my own thing. And then latterly, when my children were small and I was at the school gates with other mums, I came across somebody who'd gone back to uni about my age and was studying law. And I thought, well, gosh, I think I'd like to do that. But we, you know, we didn't have any money, my husband and I. And so to do things the traditional way was not possible. It was not possible just to go to university and do it. So what I did was I did a higher national certificate at college part-time in business and finance, but I still wanted to do this law. So I actually found a job in a lawyer's office working as a secretary stroke clerk. And I went and I studied to become what's called a legal executive, which is, it's a qualification. And I studied and I took all of the exams. I took all of the extra exams. I took everything I needed to do to get to the stage where I could go to university for a year to do my final qualification as a solicitor. And I qualified at age 45 and it was brilliant. It was really good. But I have to say, and I'm throwing this out there to you people, don't forget, sometimes the journey is better than the destination. So for goodness sakes, whatever journey you're on, just suck up and savor every single moment of it. It was fabulous. I absolutely loved the whole thing. And the privilege of actually being able to go to university was just awesome. I think I really, you know, it wasn't a wild 20s, lots of boozy parties, university experience, but just the joy of going there and being able to learn was wonderful.
Which university did you go to, Sue? Was it a local one or did you have
University of Exeter?
Oh, I know Exeter. Yeah, yes. My friends studied there. It's a great uni.
It's a great uni. Yeah.
Amazing cafe in Exeter called Harley's or Harlequins or something like that.
Yes. Yeah. Oh. It's a lovely town, Exeter. It's a pocket handkerchief city. I love a university town. I think young people bring such life to a town, and university towns have got something really, really special. And Exeter is small enough, and yet it's got this vibe. I love it there.
Yes, it's a very special place. And I don't know anybody who went to Exeter who had a miserable time either. It's a perfect sized town, I think, for studying in. And talking of studying, you're still at it, aren't you? As well as this sort of passion for philosophy, I hear you're studying Sanskrit as well. Yeah. Now. Tell me about that.
Well, I just like to know stuff. I just like to know stuff. And a lot of yoga is in Sanskrit. And you don't have to know Sanskrit to do yoga. Everything's been beautifully translated. You can read all of the ancient texts. Everything is beautifully translated. So you don't need to know Sanskrit. But I just fancied it. You know, sometimes the yoga asanas are referred to in Sanskrit. And I personally use the Sanskrit terms because wherever you go in the world, the Sanskrit is the same. It's Sanskrit. So you know exactly what somebody's asking you to do. Whereas a translation into a local language, people have different names for things. But the Sanskrit thing means, you know, you know it's what it says on the tin. And I just thought, you know, I'd like to know a little bit more about it. And the lovely Curly Whirly Devanagari script, which is actually a writing system. And I wanted to study it, and I saw a course at SOAS University. And the wonderful thing about lockdown is lots of things have gone online, which means that wherever you are now, if something's online, things that would no longer, or things that would previously not have been accessible because of your geographic location, are suddenly open to you. So I enrolled in a course, and it's absolutely brilliant. There's about 14 of us on the course, and we're from all over the world. Some people are doing masters in yoga. Some people are learning it alongside ancient Greek and Hebrew. There's people from the USA online doing it. There's people from Canada. There's people from the Netherlands. There's people from Scotland. There's me here in Somerset. And it's just a lovely, lovely course. It's really joyful. It's like doing puzzles. It's like Sudoku or Kukuru with knobs on, you know, because you get this script and you have to decipher, A, what does it say? B, what does it mean? It's just, for me, it's just a joy. It's just a bit of fun. I don't have to do this. I don't need to do this. I'm not getting a qualification. I'm just getting the fun of knowing stuff. And now it's lovely. When I look at something, I can pick out a few words. I think, oh, I know what that is. I know what that is. I know what that is. I'm not going to be reading the Bhagavad Gita in Sanskrit anytime soon, but maybe in the fullness of time. We're about to do term two. They're only going to run it if enough of us join. I've signed up, and I think about half a dozen others have, one of whom is a very nice yoga teacher from London. But we're just hoping there'll be enough people to run it. I'll be disappointed if it doesn't run. I can still carry on learning, but it's nice to have a teacher too.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, so what you're saying is, I think, that it's a bit like playing Sherlock Holmes in a way. You're sort of like looking at the clues of the shapes and you're putting together a meaning from them.
Totally. That's exactly what it's like. And then you write things out, and it's been really funny because I'm a grandma, lucky me, and I've got four little grandchildren, one of whom is just about to be five, and it's his first year at school, and he's busy learning his phonics, so he's doing all his sounds. And then he's putting letters together, and some of the letters have special friends. And I'm in exactly the same state with my Sanskrit. So he's doing his phonics, and I'm to be found making all these strange noises. And my husband looks at me, it's like, is something actually wrong with you? But it's me just kind of slightly vocalizing all the stuff that I'm trying to learn and process and put it together and learn the special friends and the rules.
Fascinating. Languages are not a natural thing for me, but I think when, like, listening to you talking about Sanskrit, I'm thinking it must be really good for your brain health as well, because you're carving out new pathways, aren't you, in your brain, in terms of like the way that you're thinking.
Oh, definitely. I mean, let's be brutally frank. I don't find it quite so easy to learn or retain knowledge as I did when I was younger. I still have the capacity to learn and retain knowledge, clearly. I mean, I'm not going to, but I could probably tell you pretty much everything about all of my open legal cases at the moment. I'm not going to tell you. But, you know, I can't necessarily remember things in quite the same way that I did when I was young, but I can still remember, learn and process stuff. And you're never too old. It's just great to pick up new skills. You know, if I've got one message out there for people, don't let age be a limiting factor. You know, you're still alive. You're here. Everything is possible. It may not be quite as it was when you were younger, but stuff is still possible.
Absolutely. Now, talking about, not letting age limit you, you have had some bumps along the road, haven't you? I mean, we've talked between ourselves before we started recording about health issues and things. Yes. That come up before. Do you think, if you want to tell us, if you could tell our listeners a little bit about that particular journey, that and twists in the path there, and whether this verve and, you know, this vivacious passion for life that you exude from every pore. So whether that comes from having to consider that there's that might end for you and not where you were expecting, or, you know, whether that's always been who you are, this like really bright, shining, effervescent woman.
I think to some extent that is my underlying essence, but probably I think one of the worst moments of my life was at age 32 with two little children, 4 and 6, a lovely husband living in the UK, parents in Australia, no mobile phones, no internet. So all you could do was write to people or have the odd phone call at a vast expense. But, you know, a very nice mother-in-law over here. I was suddenly diagnosed with a melanoma, you know, and it was absolutely devastating because as a child growing up in Australia, I was aware of what melanoma was. And, you know, I was aware of people dying of this. And I suddenly thought, oh, my God. And I just didn't know what was going to happen. I was just absolutely devastated. It was treated, you know, luckily the treatment was a little bit of surgery. It didn't require anything more. But all people could say was wait and see. We'll, you know, there's nothing more we can do, nothing more needed. Just wait and see. You know, we'll see you every 3 months. But I was absolutely in bits. So here I am, I'm 32. And I think, my goodness, this can't be game over. There's so much I still want to do. This cannot be it. You know, will my children grow up not knowing me? Have I got to start writing letters? What is going to happen here? And it made me actually stop and think, well, hold on a minute. You're not dead yet. You're still alive. At that time, I was very much into riding horses. And, you know, I just suddenly thought, well, let's just take every day as it comes. You're still alive. You're still, you know, nothing hurts. You can still do everything. So just don't look to the future. Just look at today. And if something comes your way, look at the perspective. You know, there's this thing you want to do. What are the risks? Can you die if you do this thing? Is this thing likely to kill you? Well, no. Well, what the heck are you hesitating about? Take a risk and do it. Embrace life. But yeah, it made me really stop and enjoy life and made me just grateful for everything and really want to embrace every single moment and live every moment. You know, that doesn't mean that you don't need downtime and time to yourself. And it doesn't mean, you know, when I'm effervescent and joyful for life, doesn't mean I don't have my moments. You know, I mean, nobody lives up in sort of cloud cuckoo land, planet nine all the time. You know, you have ups and downs, but, you know, I'm on a fairly even keel. I'm mostly slightly more up than down. But yeah, sure, sometimes, you know, you know, things are not always great, but usually there's something wonderful to find about it. And I think I've been blessed to see life in a certain way. I've been blessed by being born with a glass that's actually half full, lucky me. And I remember when I was 42, we were skiing in Bulgaria, and there was me and my husband and the children, and it was on the back side of a mountain, and Bulgaria was very, very poor then. It had just come out of communism. So there wasn't very much to be had. And because it was poor, things were cheap, and it was a very affordable resort for people all over Europe. And we were skiing and we were going along and we were in ski school, and a very nice vet who was in the ski class said to me, oh, so you go ahead of me on the lift. I said, oh, great, thank you. And I went, and with the same, an inexperienced skier, several skis above me in the queue fell over and started rolling down the mountain. And as I couldn't get out of his way, I was stuck on a ski button lift, couldn't get out of his way. And he actually hit me, and it broke my leg. It broke my tibia, the big bone. So I was hauled off the mountain. The whole experience was fairly horrendous, but I can look back on it and laugh. But it wasn't that much fun at the time. And I ended up in this hospital in Bulgaria, in traction with my, you know, plaster from toes to thigh. And the way I actually thought about it was, God, how lucky that was my leg and not my head. You know, and I think I'm lucky in that I can mostly see the good side of stuff. And I do think that does actually help me to process life.
Acknowledging that something serious has happened to us, but then thinking, right, what are the positives I can take forward from this experience? At least gives us an opportunity to learn, doesn't it?
Oh, definitely. Definitely.
And it's not as if, I mean, that is an accident, isn't it? You didn't,
random.
You couldn't have had that happening to you. That's not really what I meant, but that kind of like, right, breaking my leg, this is pretty serious. But what, you know, what can I do with this time? What have I learned from this experience? It could have been worse. Let's look at the positives here. And then when we meet another incident, which is similar, or we feel similar emotions, we're like, right, we've been here before. We know what the plan is here, don't we? Look to how we can reframe what we're going to learn from this and focus on that, and hopefully not make the same error again. Although I don't know about you, Sue, but I have certainly found myself going, yes, we made this mistake before, didn't we? We thought it would be different this time. Why did we think that?
On the topic of age, the funny thing was, having broken my leg, and I was 42, and the doctor back in the UK said, well, of course, older people like you don't heal so well. I'm like, what? Which older people? Which older people are we talking about? I'm only 42.
That's old science as well, isn't it? I don't know if it's because of what we do, but the health professions come across our horizons quite frequently, or it's just the age that we are that the health professions come across our horizons. But I this whole idea that, you know, osteoporosis is going to be something that we're going to be affected by come hell or high water, and there's nothing that we can do about it, and how we ate when we were 20 is, you know, just going to affect how our bones are when we're 60. That's been proved to be a nonsense. You know, we can do lots to look after our bodies and our bone health. And, you know, our cells are renewing all the time. So, and obviously yoga is such a great holistic method of supporting the body from top to toe, inside out, isn't it? And building bone strength and muscle strength and flexibility and balance.
Yes.
We need to be nimble out there as we get older, don't we?
We do, we do. I taught a yin class last night, and I made people do the toe stretch, because of course our toes are the furthest things from the total extremities. They're cased in shoes, and people's toes, if they don't look after their feet, people's toes harden up, stiffen up, and they lose their balance and they fall over. And truly, as you get older, you don't really want to be falling over.
Absolutely not. No, you want to. I mean, we're not like. Do you remember when you were a kid? I lived in roller skates for about 3 years, and you know, falling over, I don't know, 20 times a day was standard. Yes, you know, it's not the life you want to be living, is it? In your 70s?
No,
without time.
Definitely not. But yeah, I'm really big on feet. Really, really big on feet.
Me too. I've started massaging the soles, not all the soles of my students' feet, because I'm teaching via Zoom still in the UK, but my own feet, you know, it's like down the arch of them.
Yeah.
Those tendons get tight, and it just makes such a difference to how comfortable your feet are, definitely.
I think I benefited growing up in Australia, where I ran around barefoot. You know, I was always barefoot. Always had a stub toe, one of the most painful things known to man, I tell you. Running down the shop, oh bugger, well, shouldn't say that, should I? Sorry, everybody. Maybe Dina can edit that bad language.
Don't worry, Sue. I swear like a sailor myself. No. It's only a matter of time. Yeah, absolutely. Feet are very important. But another topic I wanted to cover with everybody that I talk to is the books that they hold dear to them from two angles. One that they think they read when they're younger, that they read more frequently or have read more than once, and the different meanings that they've seen in it that they maybe didn't quite get the first time.
I'm a voracious reader. It's been really hard because a lot of books I do read more than once. I just really, really enjoy them. As a novel,
fine, Sue, if you have like a collection.
Yeah, as a novel, I've always enjoyed The Far Pavilions by MMK, and I've read that so many times, set in India in the Raj. It's just a really interesting novel. I read A Suitable Boy by Vikram Seth, which I really, really enjoyed. I've read that several times. I got a lot from that. But I've got a little selection here, if I may.
So
my mum, my blessed, wonderful mum, who's 94, is a very, very wise soul. She's an old soul, and I really reckon she's probably been here before. She's just so wise. And she got me onto these books, Dale Carnegie, and they're probably from the 1920s or 30s, but human nature is human nature, because as you know, Dina, as a student of the ancient Indian literature, as I am, the people then, their thoughts, psychologies, emotions were every bit as sophisticated as ours. We think we're modern, but some things and truths are eternal. And so there is How to Win Friends and Influence People, which sounds manipulative, but it's actually not. It's basically just practical advice about and techniques about how to get out of a mental rut and make your life more rewarding. It's a great read. It's full of wonderful, heartwarming anecdotes and great ideas. And Dale Carnegie, How to Stop Worrying and Start Living. And, I can be a worrywart, less so, I think, since I've been a yogi, but yeah, can be a worrywart. And funnily enough, Dina knows my daughter, Rachel Smithbone, and who's a yoga teacher and various other sound healer, various other wonderful skills. And my other daughter, Laura, who's a software engineer. And when they came to visit Australia, they found the old versions of these books in mum's cabinet and they read them. So they got into them and we bought them for them. So they absolutely love them as well. And I've read them and reread them and I absolutely love them. I'm going to be greedy. I'm going for two more.
Okay.
By Khalil Gibran. Such a beautiful book. I don't know if you know this one, Dina.
I don't. Tell me all about it and why you love it.
Absolutely beautiful. It's sort of poetic, but it just deals with relationships and things. You know, it's got all sorts of little wisdoms about life. It talks to you about parenting, like your children come from you, but they are not you, you know, and you know, you can't control them. You can just love them and nurture them and be there, but they're not you. They're their own unique people. Or it talks about relationships, you know, like when you're in love, when you're in a relationship, you and your person that you're in the relationship with, you're like the oak and the cypress. You stand together, you grow together, but you also need to stand slightly apart. But you grow together. And it's just, there's just lots of beautiful wisdom in there. This is yogic, but not. It's like joy and sorrow both sit on your bed and they're just other sides of the same coin. And there's just so much beauty in there. I've read and read that. I love that. It's a real go-to. And finally, and you knew this was coming, the Bhagavad Gita, which I just love. It really resonated with me. I dealt with it in my yoga teacher training and I read it and I read it and I reread it and I've read it so many times, and there's different translations, And in fact, it's wonderful. It's the Bhagavad Gita is actually just a chapter from the Mahabharata. Mm-hmm. So although it's a text in its own right and beloved of literally millions and millions of people all around the world, it is actually part of a bigger epic. But it's just the story of every man. And it's just, you know, reading this is not going to turn you into a Hindu. It's not going to turn you into any particular religious faith. It just gives you skills in how to navigate life skillfully. And every time I read it, I come up with something a little bit different. And I just, it's a thing of great beauty to me and very close to my heart. So I'm sorry, I was very greedy. I went for 4.
Perfectly allowed, Sue. Books are a big passion for me as well. I think I would struggle to say 1. I think it's very interesting that we see yogic themes in other books that aren't necessarily yoga. And we tend to, it's human nature, I'm sure, this sort of labelling of things, isn't it? If it isn't this, then, you know, it's not for me because I do this. I don't do that. I read the Vedanta book that I couldn't understand 15 years ago, that I can now begin to understand. I've also learned how to read in a very different way from how I used to read, because reading a philosophy book isn't quite like reading a novel, is it? No. You know, you read a paragraph and then you think about the paragraph and then you read it again. And that's how I find that I can consume knowledge rather than just read. You know, reading is like swimming on the surface. If you want to read something and feel it penetrate your mind and your thinking, you can't just like flick through the book and then, but that's how I used to read when I was younger. I used to just like fly through things and say, oh, yes, I've read that. And then if you told me what happened, I wouldn't know.
Yeah, yes, I used to devour things. And some things I will still devour, but then I will sort of go back to them. But yeah, I totally agree with what you're saying. When you're reading something maybe a bit more philosophical, you just need to let it percolate, don't you? And sit and start to resonate.
And I managed to distract myself, as I do all the time there, by setting off on one path and then picking up another one. But what I meant to say is, even though we think these paths have got different names, we find that paths sort of cross each other as they travel up the mountain.
Yes.
And some very wise person pointed out to me that we may all be on different paths and we all may think that where we're going is very different from somebody else's path, but at the end of the day, we all end up at the top of the mountain and the view is exactly the same.
What a beautiful thought. How beautifully put.
It's really good, isn't it? It's not mine. I hate to add. I think the Vedanta book has it in the introduction, but the Vedanta book that I have isn't available anymore. It was one of those secondhand buys.
Yeah.
And it was an ex-library book, so it's been knocking around a long time, I think. But the original source of information is something that's been flagged to me as a way to go if you want to understand a subject properly, rather than look at people who've essentially reinvented what has already been invented. So the fact that you talk about Dale Carnegie, you know, so many people who are popular today or were popular 20, 30, 40 years ago were reinventing Dale Carnegie. He's recognized as a source of the, you know, self-motivation industry, isn't he?
He's actually uplifting. He makes you feel good. He makes you feel good about yourself and value yourself. It's really good. But taking your point about going back to the source, in law, we also have a saying, which is exactly your point, which is, if you want to understand something, you go back and you drink from the pure water of the statute, the source of the law, that statement of the law.
That is beautifully
put. Just literally go back to it. Well, I can't claim that one. My law professor gave me that one. You know, anytime we had to interpret something, she said, come on, we need to go back and drink from the pure water of the statute.
Brilliant. Brilliant. It's such good advice as well. It was given to me by somebody I study hypnotherapy with, and who trained with Gil Boyne, who was a really well-known hypnotherapist in the 60s and 70s in America. And he studied Gestalt with the people who were working on the emergence of that as a mental health treatment and way at looking at how we think and process emotions into the body and hang on to them sometimes. So yes, going back to the source, it is a very, very powerful thing to do.
Yes.
There was something else I wanted to ask you before I let you escape my little interrogation here. And that is, what's next for Sue? Because it sounds to me like you arrived in the UK without this divine plan that you would be here for the rest of your life. That's how things have happened for you. So are you like a planner, or are you a let's just see where the wind
blows? Seat of my pants kind of gal. I don't actually have a grand plan. I just, you know, just sort of kind of roll with things, take things as they come. Yeah, no, I'm not really. I obviously, you know, sometimes you have a plan that you want to maybe achieve something or go somewhere or do something. So you need some kind of a plan around that. But no, I don't have any particular plan on the horizon. I'm just enjoying life.
Enjoying your grandchildren and your
loving them.
Very different career paths, aren't they? Sound healing and yoga versus software engineering, did you say?
Yeah, she's an AI architect, artificial intelligence architect. So she's got a degree in software engineering and a master's in artificial intelligence from Exeter University, no less. But yes, yeah, so she's in that realm. And yes, you know, two completely different worlds. And my husband and I also have an ice cream business, Styles Farmhouse Ice Cream. So we set that up in 1988. And that was not that long after I'd had the melanoma that I referred to earlier. And we were not doing so fantastically well with farming. We're tenant farmers. We don't own the farm. We weren't doing fantastically well. Farming was going through the doldrums. And David was saying, well, we need to diversify. We need to do something different. So he'd read something about sheep milking. So he said, well, shall we give this a go? And I thought, well, we're not going to die of sheep milking, are we? Why not? What have we got to lose? So we looked at it. So, yeah, we can get these sheep. We can milk these sheep. We can do this. What are we going to do with the milk? And we looked around and we wondered what to do. And we went on a course about making yogurt. We went on a course about making cheese. Geek, read up all about it, read everything there is to know, read, and said, do you know, sheep's milk seems to have a lot of characteristics that work for ice cream. So we thought, well, we'll give that a go. So we set up a business making sheep's milk ice cream. And then we expanded it to making dairy ice cream. So we made sheep's milk and dairy ice cream, which we sell wholesale. So it goes to shops, restaurants, pubs, other people who scoop it and sell it to the public. And we also have a direct retail arm. So we service all that. We've got ice cream vans. And David's actually invented three solar-powered vans. They run like a conventional van on diesel to get from A to B. But once you're there, he switches that off, and the solar panels on them produce solar power, which goes through a battery. And you can have your Mr. Whippy and your Styles ice cream, but there's no engine running. It's all just run by the power of the sun. So yeah, we've got all that going on as well. But I although I started with the ice cream and I'm a director in a company and a shareholder, I took a different path. You know, I'm still head taster, love ice cream. Can't get enough. But you know, that is very much David's enterprise. I have a lot of other fish, as you've gathered by now, that I'm actively frying.
So the ice cream, is it still sheep's milk, or is it, or do you do cows as well?
We've actually stopped the sheep's milk. We were probably 30 years ahead of our time. People are now getting more into alternative milks, but it's really strange, because the people that have discovered it absolutely love it, but unfortunately they don't all live in one geographical area, so spread throughout the country you've got a lot of people who absolutely love it, can't get enough of it. But it gradually got to a stage where we thought, well, we're not able to just sell it in the same way that we can with the dairy ice cream. And we were working very much in partnership with a local farmer who was milking the sheep. And between us, we decided that its day was done. So we stopped the sheep's milk. So it's now all dairy, which is lovely ice cream. It's made with milk from Jersey cows.
Wow.
Farmer down in Devon. So, you know, beautiful, beautiful cows. The ones with the long eyelashes. Really gorgeous.
Fine. Beautiful. I spent a lot of time wandering around on farms when I was a youngster. I grew up in Oxfordshire, and my best friend lived in this village called Hook Norton, and there was a farmer called Bernard, if I remember rightly, and we just used to hang around Bernard's farm so we could pet the calves. And calves, you know, like calves want to just like smell you and lick you, and they're just adorable. They're such beautiful animals. Really lovely. So how many flavors of ice cream do you do, and what's best in your palate, because you are chief ice cream taster?
We do lots of flavors. I can't give you a number off the top of my head, but I suffice to say there are lots. What's the favorite? Ask me on any given day. It's like having children. You know, you love them all. You know, they're all your favorite. They're like your babies. I'm really partial to mango. I love mango, but then I'm really partial to rum and raisin. And I know it's sort of a retro flavor, but the raisins are soaked in this rum for a good 7 days. So they get all fat and delicious and rum soaked, and they go in this lovely ice cream. But then there's the raspberries and cream. So you've got all the tangy raspberries in a lovely sort of rich, creamy ice cream. And I could just go on. You know, ask me on any given day, Dina. It's really hard. I mean, you know, I'm a foodie. I love my food. I'm very, very fond of food and baking and cooking. And, you know, it's a passion.
My partner describes ice cream as the food of the gods.
I like your partner.
Wait till I tell him. Lockdown. It's going to be over soon. Yes. Trip to Sisu.
That would be lovely.
Oh, wow. Didn't mean to inadvertently just invite myself over there, but yes, he adores ice cream.
Well, you know several of us in this area now, Dina. We've got another friend, Terry Bruce.
I didn't realise Terry was near you.
He's about 8 miles away from me.
Wow, that is extraordinary, isn't it?
I've only met Terry through Amy McDonald, our yoga business coach, oddly enough.
This is how we that all know the same people, isn't it? Yeah. How we met. So this is such a wide and varied life that you've had, Sue, with, like, you know, these ups and downs. And when I say ups and downs, they always feel like mountains and then valleys, don't they? And then back up mountains and then back down into the valleys. But when you look over and around your life, what sort of advice do you wish that you could give little Sue back in Australia?
Well, it sounds a bit Baz Luhrmann, but you'll get the reference in a minute. And that is, wear sunscreen. Put on your hat, wear sunscreen, don't lie in the sun. And that is, you know, it sounds a bit flip, but it's actually really serious advice, because as I referred to earlier, I did have the melanoma, and that was a direct result of sun. In my case, they happen to other people for other reasons, but in my case, it was the sun. And of course, I'm still now dealing with little things that keep cropping up, and they, you know, that need to be burnt off or removed, you know, just little bits of sun damage that may or may not turn into something worse. So yeah, wear sunscreen. Remember to put it on the backs of your hands as well, because they catch the sun. Wear a hat, don't sunbake, because, you know, back when I was a kid, it was cool to cover yourself in coconut oil, lie in the sun and fry and get as brown as you could. Not great. You know, there are long-term health consequences, so it's actually a serious point. I would also say, listen to your parents. They know stuff. They're only trying to save you grief. Don't learn everything the hard way, which is pretty much how I've rolled. And listen to your mum when she says everything in moderation, because actually that works. And that's now modern, trendy thinking. But, you know, it was drummed into me as a kid and I didn't listen.
That's that natural need to rebel, isn't it, when you're a teenager? Yeah, and you can see with hindsight that they're not doing it to control you, they're actually trying to help you.
Yes.
Oh, Sue, that's been amazing. Thank you so much for giving so much of your time so generously this afternoon. Really enjoyed speaking to you. It's been lovely. Thank you so much.
It's been an absolute pleasure chatting with you. It's always a pleasure to chat with you. And thank you so much for inviting me.
It's been a delight, Sue. Thank you.
And here we are at the end of another edition of the Wise Life podcast. If you found this content useful, I would be very grateful if you could support this podcast by giving me a 5-star rating. And if you've got the time, a review would be amazing. And please, if you have suggestions for podcast topics, I'd love to hear them. Just DM me on Instagram @dina.morris and have a great week.